Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
La cataracte est la principale cause de cécité évitable au monde. Le métavers peut aider à traiter ce problème. La plateforme de réalité virtuelle, conçue par Fundamental VR et Orbis International, contribue à former des médecins au traitement de la cataracte, pour que davantage de chirurgiens puissent opérer en toute confiance dans le monde entier. Avec la formation en réalité virtuelle, les chirurgiens peuvent s'entraîner encore et encore pour acquérir des compétences. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday the 4th of March, these are our main stories. A state of emergency has been declared in Haiti after a deadly weekend in which armed gangs stormed two prisons and freed thousands of inmates. Apple has been fined nearly $2 billion by the European Union for abusing its dominant position in music streaming services. Hamas has said it's persevering with talks on a ceasefire in Gaza despite Israel's refusal to join the negotiations. Also in this podcast...
It's scary that it can be created. It's scary that somebody can push it out. And then from there, it's viral and it just takes on a life and a truth of its own.
We hear about the fake AI images being used to falsely portray black people supporting Donald Trump. Haiti, already one of the most dangerous countries in the world, has hit a new low in its downward spiral of lawlessness. A state of emergency and nighttime curfews have been imposed after an explosion of violence this weekend. Armed gangs stormed two of the country's biggest prisons, freeing thousands of inmates. Monique Klesker, a journalist and former UN official who lives in the capital, Port-au-Prince, says life for ordinary people there is dire.
We are very distressed. I am terrorized by what is going on. And it's not only today, but the last 3 days, it has gone up quite a bit because the gangs have taken over the streets and taken over the city, taken over practically the country. So it is a very difficult situation. Four policemen were killed and people are being displaced. And some people died with the takeover of the main prison of Haiti, which held about 4,000 people. And from what I understand, only about 100 remain behind. And it is a traumatizing situation.
Well, among those inmates who've decided to stay in their prison cells rather than risk being caught up in the violence outside is a group of Colombian mercenaries accused of assassinating the Haitian president, Jovenel Moïse, 3 years ago.
I'm an ex-military man from Colombia, and I'm here in this prison. So far, the press can't report on what this place is like. I'm innocent. I came here to Haiti with a job offer, with a proposal made to me by an American company. I didn't come here to hurt anyone. I found myself involved in a conspiracy that I don't even know why I fell into at the moment.
Haiti's gangs, who already control about 80% of Port-au-Prince, want to force the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, from power. He went to Kenya last week to discuss plans to send a Kenyan-led multinational security force to Haiti. One gang leader, known as Barbecue, told Mr. Henry to stay away, but there are reports that he may have returned. Our correspondent in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Barbara Pletasha, told us more about Mr. Henry's visit.
He came in order to sign a security deal with the Kenyans that would have removed the last major obstacle to the deployment of Kenyan police officers to Haiti. So Kenya had promised to send 1,000 police officers, which would head a multinational force aimed at bringing back law and order to the country. But that was held up in the Kenyan courts. The High Court ruled that it was unconstitutional because there wasn't a reciprocal arrangement with Haiti. So Ariel Henry was in the country to sign that reciprocal arrangement, which in theory would have allowed the Kenyan police to deploy. But of course, while he was here in Nairobi, the gangs coordinated to take over the capital and try to prevent his return. And then the question became, will he get back? What will happen now? And we understand from Kenyan police that he did leave Nairobi at the weekend, and they say that he has landed safely back in the country, in Haiti, although I'm not aware of confirmation from that end of things that he's actually arrived.
Yeah, very difficult situation in Haiti, already a very dangerous place. And there have been attempts in the past to send international forces to Haiti to try to restore order there, which haven't really worked.
Yes, and there were voices of caution about sending another international force. Do you remember the UN was accused of sexual abuse? It was accused of spreading cholera while its peacekeepers were there. And so there is that history. And then in Kenya itself, you had human rights organizations saying, well, Kenyan police don't have a great human rights record in terms of how they do their policing here. So there was caution on that end of things. But there was also a pushback from others who opposed the mission here in Kenya. They said it was unconstitutional, hence you had that legal challenge to the High Court, but that it was also inappropriate that Kenya has enough security challenges to deal with rather than sending its forces elsewhere. And in actual fact, Jeanette, it's not quite clear what will happen to this force now, given what's going on in Haiti. Will it be possible to deploy an international force there? And then back here in Nairobi, you have those who oppose the whole idea saying that they will move to the court to continue challenging it. They're going to challenge the validity of this reciprocal agreement. And some of them are saying, well, Mr. Henry actually isn't a legitimate leader, given that he has basically stood down on various promises to hold elections. In fact, he was supposed to hold them early in February. So there's still a lot of questions, really, about what will happen with this multinational force.
Barbara Plett-Usher in Kenya. And you can hear more about the history of Haiti's gang crisis by searching online for BBC World Service, The Explanation Haiti. As Hamas says it's persevering with talks on a ceasefire, despite Israel's refusal to join the negotiations, there's been another warning that the war in Gaza could cause a wider conflict in the Middle East, this time from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk.
The war in Gaza has already generated dangerous spillover in neighbouring countries, and I'm deeply concerned that in this powder keg, any spark could lead to a much broader conflagration. This would have implications for every country in the Middle East and many beyond it.
Despite these concerns, Israel has said that it won't attend ceasefire talks until Hamas gives it a list of all the surviving hostages in Gaza. But a Hamas official told the BBC that was impossible under the continuing Israeli bombardment, especially as it wasn't holding all the hostages. And in a sharpening of tone from the Biden administration, the US Vice President Kamala Harris called on the Israeli government to do more to aid the starving people of Gaza. She also called for an immediate six-week ceasefire. She's meeting the Israeli War Cabinet member Benny Gantz in Washington today. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolande Nell, has been telling me more about that. But first, she told us the latest about the Gaza ceasefire talks.
There are talks going on in Cairo involving the Egyptian and Qatari mediators. This follows on from agreements that they'd reached with Israel on a framework for a possible deal, and another temporary truce lasting this time for about 6 weeks. And that is envisaged to go through the Islamic holy month of Ramadan that starts in about a week. During that time, you would have, according to this deal, about 40 of the remaining Israeli hostages released from Gaza, and in exchange for a number of Palestinian prisoners being held in Israeli jails. Now, the block at the moment concerns the fact that the Israelis haven't, it seems, sent a delegation to Cairo saying that they want more information, first of all, from Hamas. They want an official response to what's been called the Paris framework. And they also want, in particular, a list, a detailed list of which Israeli hostages are still being held alive in the Gaza Strip.
And at the same time, we've heard some pretty strong words from the US Vice President Kamala Harris calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, talking about the suffering of the Palestinians there. And she's due to meet a senior member of Israel's war cabinet, Benny Gantz, at the White House, along with other senior American officials. And that apparently has displeased Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah, so Benny Gantz is somebody who was previously a prominent opposition figure in Israel. He joined the Israeli war cabinet, went into partnership with the Prime Minister Netanyahu, really wanting to use his past military experience and do something for the benefit of the country, he said. Now, we understand reports in the Israeli media are that his trip to Washington has really angered the Israeli Prime Minister, who is a long-term political rival of his, that Mr. Netanyahu refused to sign off on them and reportedly prohibited the Israeli embassy in Washington from facilitating or attending Mr. Gantz's meetings. There's a lot of criticism for him for that in the Israeli media and saying that he should put national interests first. But it really gives you an indication of just how deep the domestic divisions are and how deep the frustration of the US with its long-term ally. I mean, of course, Washington is the closest international ally of Israel.
Yonand Nell in Jerusalem. Donald Trump's only remaining challenger for the Republican presidential nomination, Nikki Haley, has finally won a primary in Washington, D.C. This is her first victory over the former U.S. president, and she's now earned the distinction of becoming the first woman to ever win a Republican primary. But many doubt whether she will win any more, given Donald Trump's sweeping win so far, which she's expected to further consolidate on what's known as Super Tuesday, when more than a dozen states nominate their choice. Naomi Ruckim, a news correspondent from CBS, says Nikki Haley's victory is simply a symbolic one.
It will not land Nikki Haley the Republican presidential nomination, but the former UN ambassador is celebrating her win last night in Washington, D.C. In a social media post, she thanked voters in the nation's capital, saying Republicans closest to Washington's dysfunction know that Donald Trump has brought nothing but chaos and division for the past 8 years. Still, Haley trails far behind the former president, and he's also expected to pick up hundreds more delegates tomorrow when voters in 16 states and territories take to the polls for Super Tuesday. Trump spoke confidently to a crowd in Virginia this weekend after picking up more wins in Missouri, Michigan, and Idaho. Still, though, Nikki Haley did make history last night, becoming the first woman to win a Republican primary in American history. In a post on Truth Social, Trump attacked Haley over her previous performances in the primary season. Meantime, though, if you look at the larger results and new CBS polling against former President Trump and President Biden, former President Trump right now nationally is ahead by 4 points, which is the most significant lead of the entire campaign. It seems the economy is a huge issue for voters, and we will likely see that as we head into Super Tuesday tomorrow.
Naomi Ruckim from CBS. Meanwhile, some supporters of Donald Trump are reportedly creating and sharing AI-generated fake images of black voters to encourage African Americans to vote Republican. The BBC has found dozens of these photos which falsely portray black people as supporting the Republican frontrunner. There's no evidence directly linking the images to Mr. Trump's official campaign. We heard more from our disinformation correspondent, Mariana Spring.
A lot of the images that I've uncovered as part of this investigation show Donald Trump alongside black voters. One shows him with a group of women who are smiling around him, almost like they're at a party. But on closer inspection, you can see that Donald Trump actually only has two or three fingers, not all five. And everyone looks very shiny. There are other images that show him sitting on a porch, for example, again, with a group of young black voters, and the false suggestion that he'd stopped his motorcade in order to meet these people. Now, there are AI-generated images of Joe Biden, but those tend to focus on him as an individual or him featured with other world leaders, for example, Barack Obama, the former US president, or Vladimir Putin. They're not with groups of voters targeted in quite the same way.
Yeah, quite a sensitive group of voters for Donald Trump, given his past history. What do we know about who's behind these images?
I've spoken to various US voters who appear to be their creators and who say, well, you know, it's fair game. I can make this kind of content and it sort of bolsters an image that I have or perhaps other voters have of Donald Trump. So one of the people I spoke to was a man called Mark Kay, who is a presenter on a conservative radio station in Florida. And this is what I had to say when I challenged him on the image that he'd created and shared.
I'm not a photojournalist. I'm not out there taking pictures of what's really happening. I'm a storyteller. I'm not claiming it is accurate. I'm not saying, hey, look, Donald Trump was at this party with all of these African-American voters. Look how much they love him. That wasn't the story at all.
It does give that impression, though. It does give that impression. If you didn't know it wasn't real, you'd think he's at this party and he's met all these people who support him, because it's quite convincing.
If anybody's voting one way or another because of one photo they see on a Facebook page, that's a problem.
Well, you say the images are quite convincing there. How likely is it that voters could be swayed by these pictures?
I think it's a really important thing to think about, because Mark Kay there said, well, I don't think any single piece of content will persuade someone to vote one way or another. What this is about in some ways is creating a certain narrative or a certain impression about particular candidates. And one of the people I've spoken to is Cliff Albright, who's one of the co-founders of Black Voters Matter. And what he said is this is part of a very strategic narrative targeting black voters who are a particular section of the electorate that both Donald Trump and Joe Biden, if they are running against each other, will want to win over. And I also tracked down some real voters because I wanted to understand what they think of this kind of content. One of them was a man called Douglas, who lives in Atlanta. When I showed him one of these images, he believed it was real. It confirmed the impression he and others have about Donald Trump's support for the black community. And this is what he had to say about the candidates and how disillusioned he's feeling about this year's election.
Trump and Biden are dinosaurs. If I had to lean my support towards either one, which I don't want to, in my opinion, the lesser of the two evils is Donald Trump. But I don't believe in voting for the lesser of two evils, because at the end of the day, you're still voting for evil.
Mariana, as well as those images of black voters, fake images of black voters, there's been some AI-generated content of President Biden, including a fake but convincing audio call recently. Are we likely to see more of this kind of thing during the campaign, do you think?
I think that audio is something that I'm really worried about, because actually AI technology, when it comes to image and video, it's getting very good, but there are still telltale signs like the lack of fingers or other things that you can spot in the pictures, whereas audio can be really convincing. I think particularly when it purports to be a secret recording or something you wouldn't expect a politician to say, but then it kind of confirms existing biases. So I think all of these things we have to be wary of them on our feeds in the build up to elections, not just in the US, but all over the world.
Mariana Spring. Still to come in this podcast.
3, 2, 1, ignition, engines full power, and liftoff of NASA Crew 8. Go Falcon.
As a
go
joint US-Russian crew blasts off for the International Space Station, we hear how the two countries are working together despite their differences here on Earth.
As we mark International Women's Day, discover two podcasts from the BBC World Service celebrating women around the world. Where to Be a Woman is the brand new podcast exploring in which countries women are living their best lives.
And my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for season 3. Join me, Namulanta Kombo, as I update my handbook to life for daughters everywhere.
Search for Where to Be a Woman
and Dear Daughter
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The tech giant Apple has been fined nearly $2 billion by the European Union for breaking competition laws. The penalty is for preventing Spotify and other music streaming companies from informing users about alternative and possibly cheaper payment options outside the Apple App Store. The EU Commissioner, Margrethe Vestager, said the iPhone maker had abused its dominant position in the market.
It is of fundamental importance to hold companies like Apple accountable for their violation of EU law. If Apple abuses its dominant position, we will detect such illegal behavior, we will bring it to an end, and we will punish Apple for it. The fine we impose today reflects both Apple's financial power and the harm that Apple's conduct inflicted on millions of European users.
Apple has said it will appeal against the decision, saying there was no evidence consumers had been harmed. Here's our technology reporter, Chris Vallance.
This has been a long-running dispute. It started with a complaint made by Apple's big music streaming rival, Spotify, back in 2019. And really, the EU competition bodies have pretty much sided with Spotify in this decision, in that they have said that Apple's behaviour was anti-competitive. They've gone further than that, and they've said, in a sense, that as a result of Apple's action, users of iOS devices, that's iPhones and tablets, will have paid significantly higher prices for music streaming subscriptions. Needless to say, Apple disagrees with the decision profoundly. It said in a statement that the facts simply didn't support what the EU had decided. And as a result, Apple has said it will appeal. So you can expect a continuing battle and Apple to fight tooth and nail to stop this fine, to reverse this fine.
Chris Vallance. It used to be one of the rare times a top Chinese leader took questions from journalists. Since 1993, the Premier has given an annual press conference at the end of the yearly parliamentary session. But in a sudden break with tradition, it's been cancelled ahead of Tuesday's meeting of the National People's Congress. Our correspondent in Beijing, Stephen McDonald, told us why he thinks this was.
The official reason given has been that, we've got all these extra press conferences these days with various new actors all giving media conferences, so it's not so necessary to hear from the Premier. I think the reason that most people suspect is that it's a deliberate downgrading of the Premier's power in order to boost Xi Jinping's power. So downgrading of the number two leader's power in order to boost the number one leader's power. And the reason is that it seems he doesn't want to share the limelight with anyone else, even for a couple of hours. It is funny, these National People's Congress sessions, thousands of delegates, it's all a bit of a show. These are predetermined outcomes. The press conference only fields screened questions with rehearsed answers. And so the whole thing is a sort of message from the party leadership to the people, because it's not like there's real debate going on there or anything like that.
Stephen McDonald in Beijing. They rose to fame more than a decade ago after storming a Moscow cathedral in protest against the Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Orthodox Church. Now, most members of the protest group Pussy Riot have fled their country, continuing their activism from afar. The group were supporters of the former Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, and they believe that President Putin was involved in his death, something which the Kremlin denies. Olga Borisova from Pussy Riot has been speaking to our reporter Megan Owen about her hopes and fears for the future of Russia.
I was 19 years old and I was a policewoman in Russia. And then I've quit after realizing what kind of place is it and that the system itself is designed in a way not to protect people or help them, but protect government's interests.
You're one of the most vocal critics of Putin. How safe do you feel at the moment?
Well, I feel pretty safe because I'm in, I'm not in Russia. And I think in general, if you will be paranoid all the time, fear is very counterproductive. I feel more for people in Russia right now.
So if you were to go back to Russia, what would happen?
I cannot say exactly because Russia is a very unpredictable country. Sometimes it's beautiful, but most of the time it's just terrible. But I don't have any plans to go now.
How do you view Navalny's death?
After the first shock passed, we realized that we should be more vocal and more loud and more... now, because he was a leader for so many people, lots of people felt that we don't have a leader anymore, so the hope is dead as well. When Yulia Navalny came and said, I'm going to continue his work, that really inspired lots of people.
Navalny clearly meant a lot to you. How do you see your role in the wake of his death?
It's like basically a signal to us that we can kill each of you one by one and you can't do anything, because we already killed the loudest of you, the bravest of you. And I think as Russian artists or Russian activists, it's our duty. This is what we need to do. Be vocal about this regime and try to help Ukraine.
Pussy Riot's methods have divided opinion. Some critics have called them childish. Some have said that the cathedral storming was sacrilege. What would you say to critics who don't approve of the methods that you use?
Well, we don't ask for approval. I think we just act the way we feel it. If we look at the early process of Pussy Riot, the bright, provocative, punk, I think it's just very beautiful, because this energy, it's completely opposite of this grey, bleak energy of those Czechist, you know, KGB agents that running our country.
Do you still have hope for the future of Russia?
If right now, for example, I don't know, no Putin, I don't know, he disappeared, he got killed, we still have this society, and I'm scared of this society. But I do still have hope. I still have hope because I know so many beautiful, good people like Alexei Navalny and people that are right now coming to say goodbye to him. They do that because they have hope, and they live in Russia right now in those conditions, and they still have this hope. So I don't think I have a right to not have one.
Olga Borisova of the Russian protest group Pussy Riot. Could you live on just $2 a day? For a quarter of the population of Cameroon, that's a reality, and some people there earn even less. As inflation continues to hit countries around the world, the effects are being felt especially in the Central African country, where supermarket and petrol prices have continued to rise for the last 3 years. Our reporter, Paul Njai, has been finding out how people are coping.
I'm at a food market in Cameroon's capital city, Yaoundé. Until recently, people came here to fill their baskets with fruits, meat and fresh vegetables. But with inflation 3 times higher than in 2021, Cameroonians are now having to count every franc.
53-year-old Stella Ancho lives with 12 other family members in a tiny apartment on the outskirts of Yaoundé.
But this my family had to suffer because you no get rent.
My family is suffering. Whenever the landlord comes asking for rent, we can't afford to pay.
I see how the fridge is empty.
She takes me to see the fridge. Inside, there are only bare shelves and stains where food was once stored.
They know they think the wrong deal for market.
When we got here, we could buy food with small amounts of money. But now the products have become so expensive in the market. Traders told us it's because their transporters complain that fuel prices have also increased.
Cameroon is the 7th most expensive country in Africa, according to an online global database of quality of life data. A quarter of Cameroonians lives on less than $2 per day. That's enough to buy 2 kilos of rice, but not enough to buy 1 liter of milk. Poor harvest, insecurity, and low productivity are among the main causes of rising costs. Transport has also become more expensive. The government slashed fuel subsidies to qualify for a multi-million dollar loan from the IMF last year. Since then, diesel prices have increased almost 30%.
The money that I used to come and feed the family with, you say come and
feed. The money we used to feed the family now goes to fuel the car.
Blaise Veda is a taxi driver in Yaoundé.
We are just managing. We pray that
We pray that the government gives us something so we are able to cope. At the moment, it's very difficult for us.
Cameroon's government has introduced measures aimed at cushioning the surging cost of living. Since last year, it increased the minimum wage from $60 to $70 and gave civil servants a 10% pay rise. But government's measures are likely to have a limited effect on most Cameroonians. According to data from the International Labour Organization, around 90% of workers operate in the informal sector, like food sellers and market traders. Kennedy Tumenta is an economist and business advisor.
If the government continuously accepts the pressure from the IMF without looking at the impact of such pressure on the citizen itself, the government should be prepared to see retaliation from the citizens at different stages. Either social unrest, or many citizens will decide that Cameroon is not affordable for them and they will have to emigrate or get out of the country.
For now, people like Stella expect their elected representatives to provide a tangible solution to feed their families.
I'm asking the government to help me and to help pay my house rent and assist my children in school.
That report was by Paul Njie. A SpaceX rocket carrying three US astronauts and one Russian cosmonaut has blasted off from Florida, bound for the International Space Station. Here's the moment it took off.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition, engines full power, and liftoff of NASA Crew 8. Go Falcon.
The joint U.S.-Russian crew are on a six-month mission. Space is one of the few areas where the U.S. and Russia continue to cooperate, as Keith Cowing, a former NASA employee and the editor of the website NASA Watch, explains.
Let me do the Russian thing first. We don't get along with Russia down here on Earth, but up in space for the past 25 years, other than a few hiccups here and there, everybody gets along. And when things are bad down here, they're okay up there. So, you know, people say, why are we doing all this stuff in space? There's a reason to do all the science up there. But one important thing is maybe we're learning how to get along with each other up there. Maybe that can be applied back down on Earth. Just a silly thought. At this point, the space station is fully functional. It's got everything that it's going to have. And there's something for everybody. There's biology, there's space medicine, there's material science, there's engineering, there's communications. Pretty much, and they have 200 or so different things they'll be doing in the course of the 6 months that they'll be up there. So they'll be busy. And, you know, when you arrive in space, some people do get a little bit of nausea, and that takes a day or so to clear. But after 4 or 5 days, the crew that's arrived is saying goodbye to the crew that's leaving, and you're pretty much in place. And after a week or so, you're in the groove. And then you've got a whole series of things that you've got to do. You've got some time off. And, of course, there's something called the Earth below, and there's a lot of looking out the window as well and a lot of media stuff. So it's a choreographed series of things with a little time off for the crew to just kind of drink in what's going on up in space.
Keith Cowing, editor of NASA Watch. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Ehrlich. The producer was Harry Bly. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.